150 deals getting done, over $500 million being handed out, over 200 and something years of contracts doled out. I thought the cap was flat. Were you surprised at all the action and all the big money we saw getting handed out early on in free agency? I'll get you on that before we slide into the Leafs.
Yeah, I was. Especially when you look at what happened in the 2020 offseason, it seemed like GMs were a lot more reasonable, frugal, smart, however you want to term it, with their money. Outside of Dougie Hamilton, and maybe you want to throw Alex Ovechkin in there, but there weren't like that many massive names. A lot of mid-tier players got a lot of term and a lot of money. Like, you know, you see Cody Ceci go to Edmonton on a pretty lucrative deal. Like, depth defensemen, like, second, third pairing defensemen made out like bandits. And, you know, to keep the story local, what it said to me was Kyle Dubas made the exact right choice at the expansion draft in protecting Justin Hall, because at $2 million bucks for a guy who plays top 4 minutes on the right side, that looks like a steal now. Just the prices GMs were paying for defensemen in particular were crazy. And then even wingers, like guys like, you know, Jaden Schwartz, who might be on the downside of his prime, or guys like Brandon Saad, like those guys got paid very nice contracts. And it Coleman, Goudreau, you know, there's a lot of, you know, kind of middle six wingers that really cashed in big time. Hyman, of course, like, you know, good on the players, like get every dollar you can, but there's going to be in 2-3 years, we're going to be looking at this class of free agents and saying, okay, there's some buyouts due here now.
So I'm glad you brought up the Justin Hall thing, because I wanted to amend my take on that on the air about how I thought that was a dumb mistake and that they would never have taken him. And with hindsight, they definitely would have taken him. And secondly, how good does that TJ Brody contract look now, a year removed? Like, what would he have gotten on the free agent market this year? It's crazy that he's making $5 million. I feel like he was a free agent 1 year too early.
Yeah, good call by you. Exactly. Yeah, last year was the year to buy. And that was, I loved watching TJ Brody play. I mean, he scored one goal in the playoffs and one goal all regular season, but that's not why you got him, right? He was just consummate shutdown guy. He had maybe two games where you're like, it was a bit of an off game. But the other 50-some games, he was like, you could count on him like a drumbeat. Like, he was just Mr. Consistency. Actually, that was Sheldon Keefe's nickname for him, Mr. Consistency, because that's what he brought. Like, and the perfect partner for Morgan Rielly, too. Really settled his game down. And I absolutely love the pickup of Brody. And, you know, that's the best defensive performance by the Toronto Blue Line since I started covering the team, like, in memory. So let's see if they can do it again. It'll be really intriguing what Sandin can add to the group with a little bit more experiences after getting a taste in the playoffs there.
So if second pair D are getting these huge contracts, you know, and Seth Jones just got a biggie, you know, there's a guy at the top of the pecking order, plays with TJ Brody, who's going to need a new deal, and this team has some cap problems. I love Morgan Rielly. I love how he played with TJ Brody last year. I love the way that the D finally looks stabilized for the first time in seemingly what feels like a generation for this Leafs team. But I'm looking at the guy trying to read the tea leaves 12 months from now, or I guess 9, depending on what the new offseason looks like. And I just can't see a world where Morgan Rielly fits in this team's cap. I would love for him to sign the deal that has him with this group for the rest of the Coors run and all of those things. But it just seems to me like, given all the money that's handed out to lesser D than him, it seems to me like you'd have to consider exploring a trade, because it just feels there's no way you can fit him under the cap next year.
I don't see it unless you move one of the four forwards. Like, that's the only way. You can't pay him what he's worth on the market. Like, Zach Werenski last night got over $9 million, he's coming. He's a bit younger and coming off a year in which he scored a bunch of goals. But this is the type of contract at the high end that Morgan's going to be looking at. I don't think he's quite there with Seth Jones and Dougie Hamilton and Werenski. I think, you know, the league views them as maybe half a step below those guys. But, you know, if you're Morgan Riley, it's got to start with an eight, I would think. So they're in a bit of a pickle. And it seems like they've already made up their mind, because I haven't heard any rumblings that they're going to move them. I do know that some teams inquired, at least, which is, you know, just, you know, opposing GMs doing their job. You gotta ask it when a guy's out 1 year from UFA. But I get no sense that Kyle Dubas wants to trade him. I think it's one of those things where he looks at it, he sees Morgan's number at $5 million and says, we have 1 year of great value on this guy. Let's see if we can make a run. And if we don't, I might lose my job anyway. So it all signs point to them keeping him, although the market to trade him would be fantastic, I think, just considering the trades that defensemen are getting and also the contracts. But it feels like it might be Zach Hyman all over again, where you love the player, you love the cap hit right now, but you run a serious risk of letting him walk for absolutely nothing. And your prospect pool and your number of draft picks isn't that great right now.
Well, the thing for me with the idea of a Riley trade and letting him walk for nothing is, if you hadn't seen Seth Jones go for the price, and I'm not talking about the contract he got, I'm talking about what Chicago gave up to get him. If you hadn't seen such monstrous deals, I would say, I don't know that this team needs to recoup just a couple of assets just to not have Riley on the team this year. But when you, and again, I understand he's not valued the same way throughout the league as Jones is, so maybe it's not quite that deal. But a good young defenseman who can play in the league right now, who is a top 15 pick, another first-round pick, and a second-rounder going for that, it just feels to me like you have to look at those things. And then it's not just about the player that you have in Riley. It's what's below him on the depth chart. You know, no one's saying Rasmus Sandin is ready to be Morgan Riley right now. But I think he has a lot more to give, and I do think there's a world where if you moved Riley, yes, the D takes a hit. There is not someone as good as him to replace him. But it feels to me like you can still get somewhat close to the level that they were at last year without him, and that's, to me, why I would consider it.
Yeah, no, I think it's worth considering. I just think maybe they missed the boat, right? Like, the teams that were really active in, like, hey, we want to trade for a defenseman, and we're willing to pay through the nose to make it happen. Chicago, Philadelphia, but they did it, right? But if that was your decision, I think Kyle Dubas would have had to make that be his plan heading into draft weekend. And there was no sense that that was his decision. I think he decided that he's going to keep him. But I agree with you, like, the return is fabulous. And what's going to be fascinating to me is, where are they going to play Riley? Like, obviously the Brody Riley pairing works very well. I imagine, you know, he's going to log his 20 some minutes a night at even strength. But what was interesting to me was, towards the end of the season, going into the playoffs, all of a sudden he loses his spot on the number one power play unit to Sandin. And Keith seemed really interested in giving the youngster some looks there, and he didn't look too bad. So it's like, Morgan Riley doesn't really kill penalties too much. And if he's not on your top power play unit, like, it's kind of like he's getting phased out anyway. So it's going to be fascinating to try, because there's, you know, Keith has to make good use of Riley, but he also has to have Sandin take a step forward in his development. And that's one of his greatest strengths, is running a power play.
Yeah. So last one for me, Luke, and it's just kind of more of a philosophical thing with Dubas. And so it's the remaking of the bottom six, you know, going from sort of the skill bottom six with the Kapanens and the Janssens in that way, and then kind of transitioning into the gritty veteran side of it, and now going into sort of, I don't want to say it, but kind of the no-name way to do it, you know, like with the guys that maybe they're trying to find value in with the Buntings and the Camps. I mean, do you like the way he keeps remaking the bottom six, changing his philosophy kind of year to year? Do you think this is something that's going to work? Or are you on my side of it where it's kind of impossible to build chemistry? It's kind of a weird thing to have brand new teammates every year, kind of switching things around. Which side of it do you land on with the bottom six philosophy that they have? I know they kept Spezza and Simmons, by the way, and there's other guys that are in there, but just different guys that they keep rolling in and out.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a big fan of it, but this is what happens when you pay four guys all the money. You end up top heavy. So you have to do it like this. You have to, every single offseason, kind of patch together something at the fringes and hope it works. And I think that's been a real point of focus and emphasis, is to try to create a third line that's just a shutdown line, that you don't really care if they score because you're paying $40 million for the other guys to score. But if they can go up against one of the other team's top two lines and completely neutralize them, you take that as a win. Like if it's net net, and then you hope your big guns outscore the other guys, and it maybe frees up one of the other Toronto top two lines to get a weaker matchup and take advantage of that. So, you know, for me, the perfect guy for that would have been Philip Deneau, right? He doesn't score goals, but he doesn't allow goals. But they weren't in that tax bracket in terms of free agents. Yeah. They were nowhere close. So what they do is they end up with David Kampf. You know, good analytics, zero offense in this guy's game, but he can take a ton of D-zone draws. And then if he loses the D-zone draw, he's good at still, you know, recovering and helping drive play out of the zone. And hopefully that means Tavares and Matthews take fewer D-zone draws, and they're put in more prime opportunity to score, and you take advantage of it that way. So we'll see. I mean, this is the thing, right? This is the Kyle Dubas model. You change the fringe pieces every summer, and you hope there's some chemistry. You hope there's some breakout and some good stories. Galchenyuk was a good story for a while. Jimmy VC was not a good story. Travis Boyd didn't work out. But you gather all these pieces and hope that you catch them at the right time. Maybe Michael Bunting breaks out and becomes a really good second line left winger. Maybe he doesn't. You know, it's kind of like create an internal competition, take some inexpensive flyers on guys that you can bury their contracts in the minors for very little cost, and hope you strike gold.